Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Minnesota artist Kent Nerburn was in town recently from his new home just outside Portland, Oregon, to talk about his latest book, Dancing with the Gods, Reflections on Life and Art. He calls it his elder book, collected wisdom about creativity and how to live an artistic life, which isn't quite the same as living life as an artist. Nerburn started his career as a sculptor before turning to become an author. He's become known for his deeply spiritual work, including his explorations of Native American spirituality. When we sat down, I asked him what inspired this new book.
It came out of really three tributaries, very disparate tributaries. And one was all my work with the Native people have really given me a different approach to aging. That, you know, their whole world, instead of seeing life as a straight line from birth to death with the period of productivity in the middle and becoming vestigial at the end, is seasons. And only the one in the last season of life has seen all the other seasons and can speak, hopefully, with intelligence and equanimity about what went on before. And so I was actually in a sweat lodge on my 60th birthday in Pine Ridge. And I remember it came time to pray and make a petition. And I said, I want to learn how to be an elder. And so the time came when it was time for me to write what I thought was my elder book. And I thought, my responsibility is to turn and face my audience. Normally the way that my writing has always been is come along with me as a fellow traveler and we'll learn together as we walk through the world and hopefully we'll see something of value traveling together. But in this case, it was no, I have to turn and face you and tell you what I've learned. That's my responsibility as an elder in the arts. And I thought the only thing I can speak to with any authenticity is the experience of being in the arts. I spent, you know, got a doctorate in theology and arts. I was with many, many types of artists at that time. I worked for 20 years as a sculptor, then 30 years as a writer. I know what the core element and core elements are of working in the arts. So that was number one. The second one was I received a letter from a young woman, and I get a lot of letters. Anyone who's in the arts gets letters, and people that, you know, they're throwing a lifeline out. They like what you are, or they admire what you are, and they say, please, what should I do to be part of this world? And I'd received many of those, and this was from a woman named Jennifer. But it happened to touch me, and it resonated with a time in my life when I'd gone to graduate school. I was here at the University of Minnesota back in the Bob Dylan, hunched down the railroad tracks and drinking cheap wine, you know, smoking dope under light bulbs in basements at times. And I went out to Stanford and in graduate school, and Stanford was the worst fit possible for me. And I don't blame Stanford, but it certainly was not a good fit. And so I said, I got to get out of here. What can I do? I want to write. I want to do something. I wrote to Norman Mailer, and it was utter embarrassment when I think about it now. I wrote to Norman Mailer, said, can I come to you in New York and work with you? And, you know, expect Norman Mailer to be a sort of a gruff character. He wrote back this incredibly kind note. And I actually quoted.
Although he did say no.
He did say no. Well, he said, doubtless say, I think it's quoted in the book. I actually have the copy of it in the book, but he said something like, you know, doubtless your mood has changed, but write more than you have. And it was really very innocuous, but it was kind. And I grabbed onto that, like that lifeline that that young Jennifer wanted from me. So at that point, I realized what it was I had to do. I had to write the book for all the Jennifers in the world in a way to pay back the gift that Norman Mailer had given me and to sort of fulfill my obligation as an elder in the arts. So that's how the book came to be.
Because it's easy enough to say, I'm going to be an elder now, let me write a book. But, uh-huh. But knowing you in particular, it's probably, you probably spent a lot of time processing this. And then it has to be said, the book is, it's remarkably concise. I mean, you have taken a whole, I mean, essentially centuries of information about being an artist and distilled what many other artists have said to create a very easily digestible guide to some of the pitfalls, some of the joys. And
joys
some
of the pitfalls. Yeah, I actually wanted to entitle it something like The Hidden Joys and Unseen Challenges of a Life in the Arts, but that was too long. This was a British publisher, and they said, oh, no, we'll just call it Reflections on Life and Art. So, but no, I again, sometimes you find something that you feel, I can do this. And the fact that I'd always been a sculptor in the way that I write, I don't line things out. I instead get this great block of thought and chip away at it until it's pared down to essentials. And hopefully I'm moving gently over deep waters. And this, as a book of reflections rather than essays, really does try to touch the core elements of being an artist. And it was done with that intention of making it simple and accessible. I mean, you know, the great god of the books on life in the arts is Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet. And, you know, that's one of those things that, you know, you can't even touch, you know, the hem of his cloak. But nonetheless, that was kind of, I was thinking, that's what I want it to be like. I wanted to speak with that intimacy, with that depth, and that accessibility. And I really wanted to write to people who were sort of desperately wanting answers. There's such a loneliness in the arts and such risk. And people that are just starting out, they're afraid, they're full of dreams, and they don't know what it is. They just know that for whatever reason, they feel compelled to create. People don't always respect it, or sometimes they get it in the wrong perspective. But these people, they care. I wanted it to be to the people that are sitting alone in their rooms as young people saying, oh, I dream of creating something great in my life. I don't know if I have it in me. I don't know if I have a capability, but I dream of doing this. What's it like? So the book is really intimate. I mean, I want it to be reflective and intimate. And, you know, it was a risk, but there's a risk in creating. And I wanted to touch that risk both in my own work and in what it was that they would be hopefully hearing and reading when they looked at it.
One of the things which really struck me is that I grew up when age and I would read comic books, and there would be ads in there saying, learn how to be an artist and make $1 million or something like that. And one of the things that you definitely do not promise in this book is that the success will bring wealth or happiness or whatever. And you talk about the, in a way, sometimes you just have to be satisfied with having done as best as you can do. But given that, you also have to realize that there are some times when you have to stop, because you can't, if you try any harder, you're going to destroy what you've created. I mean, that's probably not a message that a lot of people want to hear.
No, and there are times, I mean, it's a cruel, you know, the arts are a cruel mistress, because they can really deceive you. Everybody hits arid times and arid places. And there's a postpartum at the end of every project. And arts, that therein lies the real key to survival in the arts, is recognizing that, as I said in one of the chapters, that bills are consistent, income is not. Every art form is project-based. You get done with one, and you're essentially fired, or you've given birth, or you're emptied of it, and you have to go through this whole process of finding what the next work is, finding your own next project, finding the next commission. And there's an emotional and a psychological as well as an economic aspect to doing that. And sometimes you get to these dry places, you're walking through a very arid desert, and you have to ask yourself, am I empty? Am I done? I mean, I'm going through some of that right now, saying I know better, but I also don't know where the next project is. And sometimes you find out that you're a person who ultimately should be more concerned with the artistry of everyday life than creating art from nothing. I mean, I'm a real believer that there's, in sort of the Japanese approach, that there is art in everything. Everything can be elevated to an art form. And the art of the nurse, the art of the physician, the art of the mechanic, the art of the homemaker, that you can find artistry in all of those things. But that's very different than creating from nothing and, you know, pulling it out of your imagination, placing it out there before the world. Maybe you're not suitable. It's not a suitable route for you to be a person who creates ex nihilo like that. Maybe what you really need to do is find the artistry inside a different profession. I mean, ultimately, as people may not agree with me, but the teacher is more important than the artist to me. That what they do is more immediate and more succinctly essential in the world. The arts may be essential. I should probably put it that way. The arts are essential, but there are things that are more immediately important and more immediately needed in the world. And maybe you're more cut out to do that kind of thing. And I thought hard about writing about that, because it's saying maybe there's a different way for you to be an artist than to act in this incredibly difficult, economically onerous and almost impossible world of making a life as an artist. So that was a very important thing for me to lay out there. So if people want to say, I'm done, this is not what I meant to do, and if you really are meant to do it, although it sounds like a platitude, it comes back. You'll find a time and when it'll resurface. And as we all know, nothing you do in life is not without its significance and importance in shaping the narrative of who we are by the time, you know, you get to the end of the road. So, yeah.
You do write, though, about the joys mm-hmm. of when it all comes together, that moment of creation where you work and you realize suddenly you've been doing this for 12 hours straight, mm-hmm. but it's felt like, you know, a couple of minutes. And I think many people would go, man, I would give anything for that experience. But this is a thing that you have experienced in both as a sculptor and as a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a more natural writer than I was as a sculptor. I always thought sculpture was probably more important to in some, you know, vague theological sense to saving my soul. Sculpture was the way it was going to be done, but I was not a natural, whereas I can write more naturally. And I wanted... There's something that happens when you're creating something that you get taken up in sort of the incandescent present, and it's a magical experience. And we all know it in our own lives in some form or another when time stands still. Like I talked about how when I was standing over a bench in Germany, the first time I ever picked up a chisel, and I was lost and alone in that country, and they had the workshop I was working in with this antique restorer. I asked the man if he would give me a block of maple or a block of wood that I could work in, because I'd been wandering the streets going to these old museums and seeing this farmer art that was lacking in technical skill but just heart poured into it. And I stood over that block of maple the first night I got it, and it was 10 o'clock, and I went into the studio, and they had all gone home and everything was shut down, and I started hitting on it with this chisel. Didn't know how to hold the chisel, didn't know how to do anything, and I couldn't stop. And at 5 in the morning, I looked up at the clock, and there it was. I'd been working for, 7 hours, and there'd been no passage of time, and I'd never experienced that in my life. And I said, whatever this is what I want. And every art form has it, where suddenly you're inside, that you actually, I think this is why people talk so much about art as a religious experience, that suddenly it feels like something has taken you over. And you may get it only for moments, you may get it for a long period of time, but it's that magical, I say sometimes as a writer, I feel like I'm dragging a stone up a hill. I'm working on an endless term paper. And other times, it's like I walk into a garden and I can't stop discovering. Oh, look at this flower. Look at this color. Look at this leaf, this branch. And you become animated by the experience. And it feels like it's something from the outside that's taking you over. And once you've experienced that, you're desperate to find it again and again. And it's not easy. Finding how to court that and create it in your own life is a very personal task. But that's what drives artists, I think.
We're talking today with Kent Nerburn, the author of Dancing with the Gods, Reflections on Life and Art. You talk about, as you mentioned earlier, maybe you may discover that you feel you have artistic talents, but maybe your talents are best used in other professions. But I think there is a feeling amongst some people that deep down everyone is an artist.
Everyone,
you just have to find what that form should take. Do you believe? Is everyone an artist?
Yes. I really struggled with that distinction, that I made in there between art and artistry. And I was always taken, as I started to discover different aesthetic theories and ways of looking at life, with the Asian way of elevating everything to an artistic practice. The place where nothing more can be added and from which nothing can be taken away. And I see it, you go to a doctor, you can tell the doctor who knows how to sit with you, how to calm certain people, how much information to give someone else. You can see them processing and making the decisions of how to touch this person in a way that communicates with them without creating fear in them. In any other form, I always think of teachers because I love watching teachers and I admire what they do so much. The ones who know how to, or parenting even, they all require a deft touch, a touch of artistry. And the big thing is feeling that you are accomplishing something, that you are practicing the art of parenting. You're practicing the art of teaching. And I think it's everywhere. We really need it. We live in a pretty tawdry world right now, and it needs mindfulness. It needs aesthetic uplifting. And really, that kind of one of the goals in the book is to just say there is an artist in all of us, and it doesn't necessarily have to come out in one of the traditional art forms. But, I do believe it, but it's a constant struggle to find the work of artistry. You sit here and do interviews. When you nail it, when you miss it, when you're present, when you're not. But you've done it for so many years that there's an art form to doing it right. And how we dance around that art form in our life is something that's a joy to watch. If you just start looking for it in other people, seeing, here's the real artist. Here's the artist of the woman in the, in the diner. I see her. I see this waitress at work, and if she becomes aware of what it is she can do and how wonderfully she does it, they're a joy to behold. And I think it makes your own life richer if you see the artistry in what you do. So I'm real committed to that notion of the artist in everyone, and that we all take satisfaction in our own artistry.
How do you hope? How do you think people will use Dancing with the Gods?
I hope it gets into the hands of young people. It really is, like I said, it's my elder book, turning and facing them. My son went to Purpich here, and I got to know the young artists, the young people at Purpich. I see that yearning. I want it to get into curricula in various places. I want this to be a book that kids take in. It's an intimate book. I want them to take it at night and read it. And when they're starting to have doubts, or they say, I don't dare have the dreams that I have. It isn't fair. I'm just an ordinary person. I want them to be able to read it and say, no, this man understands what I'm going through. Just like I did with, I thought Norman Mailer understood it, what I tried to say to Jennifer. Really, I know when I wrote it and the editors want to said, we have to make it applicable to everyone, the retirees who are in the arts and have decided to start painting. And yes, there's things for everyone there. But I want it to be reach out to the young people. I want it to have the same intimacy that actually the first book I wrote, Letters to My Son, had. That it really is an attempt to touch people at a heart point and in their loneliness and their dreams. And it's for young people. At least that's my faith. So, you know, I'm happy if everyone reads it and everyone enjoys it. But if I can get to the Jennifers of the world, that's really what I want.
Kent Nerburn talking about his new book, Dancing with the Gods, Reflections on Life and Art. It is published by Canongate Books. To hear our full conversation, you can go to nprnews.org and subscribe to the NPR News with Kerry Miller podcast. Incidentally, he told me that while he's enjoying living in Portland, Oregon, he is considering moving back to Minnesota because he finds it easier to write in the North Woods.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @KerryNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.